Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Welcome back to The Takeaway. As hospitals across the country face an increasing number of coronavirus patients, early data shows people of color are testing positive and dying at much higher rates. In Milwaukee, one of the few places that has released a racial breakdown of COVID-19 cases, African Americans made up 81% of deaths in a county that is only 27% Black. And in Black communities across Michigan, Illinois, and North Carolina, there are also a high number of reported cases. But severe shortages of medical equipment and staff across the country mean that healthcare providers are now forced to make decisions about whose life to save in critical situations. And that means racial bias could play a role in how doctors allocate life-saving treatment. I spoke with Kiara Bridges about this. She's a professor of law at the University of California, Berkeley School of Law. And she writes about race, class, and disparities in healthcare. And I also spoke with Douglas White, the vice chair and professor of critical care medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. He also directs the program on ethics and decision-making in critical illness. First, I asked Doug how these critical decisions are typically made in hospitals.
In ordinary circumstances, decisions about, for example, whether to use a ventilator or admit a patient to intensive care really come down to an individualized conversation between a doctor and the patient, if the patient is awake and able, or the patient's family, focused on both the patient's medical prognosis and the patient's values and preferences. So if the patient has a condition that is potentially treatable and the patient wishes to receive life-prolonging treatment, then the doctor and the patient or family collaboratively make a decision. In contrast, if there is a public health emergency where there is a true and severe shortage of ventilators, for example, the situation is really different in the sense that decisions will be made in ways that are not as focused on the individual well-being of patients so much as focused on maximizing the outcomes of the population of patients being served in that region.
So let's sort of dial back a little bit. And Kiara, I want to bring you in here, because before a patient gets into a hospital setting or an intensive care unit, there are a lot of different healthcare professionals along the way making decisions. Can you talk about what we know about bias against people of color along that journey?
People of color in this country are sicker and die earlier. And so scholars like myself working in this space have tried to figure out why that is. And a lot of the conversation has centered around bias, and specifically implicit bias. And the idea here is that providers, doctors, nurses, care providers along the entire chain have unconscious associations and aversions. And so by unconscious, it means that they're not exactly aware of them. So if you ask a provider, you know, do you think Black people are criminals? They'll say no. If you ask anybody if you think Black people are criminals, most people would say no. And they'll be honest. You know, they're not lying to you. The idea with implicit bias is that there is an association, for example, between Blackness and criminality, between Blackness and laziness, between Blackness and mendacity, you know, untruthfulness. And so these unconscious associations are manifested and usually under extreme time constraints. So when you're in a highly pressurized situation like an emergency room where there's a shortage of everything from masks to personal protective equipment to ventilators, this is an incredibly constrained environment. You know, it's just stressful. And so it's in those environments that people are going to act on their implicit biases, even though if you ask them, they would not say anything about being averse to people of color or preferring white people over people of color. And so the idea is that well before you've arrived at that place, that time when you're trying to figure out whether to admit somebody to ICU to give them a ventilator, people of color have encountered biases along the way in terms of, or have they been treated for the hypertension that they might have had? Have they been treated for diabetes? Have they been given the quality healthcare that would allow them to be healthier so that they're not in a situation where they need a ventilator at the end of life?
One of the reasons we're talking about this right now is obviously the coronavirus pandemic. And Doug, you developed a new set of guidelines for hospitals to help them make ethical decisions right now. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works?
This work dates back over a decade to the time that the avian influenza epidemic was going on, and then around the time of the H1N1 pandemic. And the existing guidelines from professional societies at the time we viewed to be highly ethically concerning, because they recommended simply excluding from access to ICU care patients with certain characteristics, for example, those with advanced age, those with severe heart and lung problems, and those with cognitive impairments. And we viewed those to be, frankly, just discriminatory features of the guidelines. And so we set out to develop a very different approach. And the gist of that approach is that rather than excluding patients from ICU care, all patients who are normally eligible for ICU care remain eligible. And priority is given according to the likelihood that an individual will benefit, as defined by their likelihood of surviving to hospital discharge and beyond, according to objective measures. And so rather than saying these classes of people are excluded, everyone is included, and we go as far down the list as we can based on the availability of scarce resources.
Do you think having that kind of, I guess, checklist or framework helps doctors and care providers go back to the guidelines in an emergency situation?
I do. You know, I think the concerns that Kiara raised around implicit biases coming out in time-pressured circumstances are well taken. And so having clear guidance that clinicians can look to in very stressful circumstances, we think will decrease the bias in decisions and make decisions across classes of patients more consistent.
Kiara, Doug is talking about a lot of things that often are referred to as comorbidities, sort of other medical things that are going on. How important are issues of comorbidity when we're talking about patients of color?
So a person who has a history of malignancy, for example, so if you are a cancer survivor, or if you have diabetes, if you have asthma, if you have a kidney disease and you've been receiving dialysis, right? All of those conditions place you at higher risk for developing more severe cases with the coronavirus. And so when I said earlier that Black people are sicker and die earlier than white people, it means that Black people more frequently have those comorbidities. So Black people more frequently have asthma. I mean, one of the causes of asthma is, you know, environmental, so living in a polluted environment. So people of color have been forced to live in really unhealthy environments, and the consequence of that is that we have higher incidences of asthma. People of color more frequently suffer from diabetes. We less frequently survive it. We less frequently survive cancers. And so all of the things that place people, individuals, at a higher risk of developing very severe cases of COVID-19 are all of the things that people of color have more frequently than white people. And so I think that the framework that Doug has developed is great, right? I think that standardization is incredibly important. It takes away the provider's discretion to decide, you know, I have a white patient who's 65 and, you know, privately insured, and he's the CEO and his family loves him very much, and I have to decide whether to give the ventilator to him, or a Black patient who's 50, but he is, quote unquote, just a janitor, or he might have Medicaid. Or so the standard that the framework that Doug has developed will sort of remove the bias from that, the discretion, the ability for a physician to discriminate really in favor of the class privileged, race privileged person over the class unprivileged, the race unprivileged person. But I think that at that moment, a lot of bias, a lot of discrimination, a lot of racism has occurred already. It precedes that moment, and that in the effects of that racism is in the comorbidities that people of color tend to have more frequently than their white counterparts.
People will listen to this and say, well, these presumed biases against people of color are really about class. Mm-hmm. But you have written that that is not the case. Can you explain that a little bit?
Sure, absolutely. So 3 to 4 times as many Black women as white women die on the path of motherhood. And a lot of people, the intuition is to explain that disparity in terms of class. And the intuition has been that, well, you know, we all know that people of color disproportionately bear the burdens of poverty. And so the idea here is that people of color disproportionately die during pregnancy, childbirth, and shortly thereafter because they're disproportionately poor. However, that is not true. Those racial disparities in maternal mortality persist across income levels. So even when you're at the higher end of the socioeconomic ladder, when you are class privileged, when you might be a professor of law at UC Berkeley School of Law, I am more likely to die than my white counterpart at UC Berkeley School of Law. So we can't explain racial disparities in health simply in terms of class, and class does do some work towards making it more likely that people of color are sicker and will die earlier, but it does not do all of the heavy lifting. And so the moral of that story is that race matters, right? Race persists even in the post-civil rights era where we don't have sort of formal disenfranchisement of people of color. The structures that we have erected, the institutions that we have, the systems that we have in place have continued to function to limit the quality of the lives that people of color have, even when they have some degree of class privilege.
Doug, when we talk about training healthcare workers, how do hospitals incorporate thinking about implicit bias when they are doing that? And does that still get kind of equally factored into an institution's thinking when you are in an all-hands-on-deck kind of situation?
Great questions. First, on the issue of training, I've been heartened to see in the last decade much more focus of this, both in the undergraduate medical training, as well as in the training of residents and fellows in the hospital who go through a variety of trainings around implicit bias and other aspects of bias and discrimination. And then on your second point, I think the point that Kiara raised is right on the money, which is that these things are unconscious. And so it's not that someone is turning it on or off on purpose in a stressful time. It's that these things may be more likely to unearth themselves at these times when physicians are relying on what we call heuristics, which is, you know, fast and frugal mental shortcuts to make hard decisions in time-pressured circumstances. And frankly, that's why in the framework that we've developed, we have put in place a recommendation that it should not be bedside doctors who are making these decisions, and instead it should be a team called the triage team who are not engaged in bedside decision-making, don't have obligations to individual patients, and instead have a much broader and hopefully more objective view of the lay of the land in the hospital and how many beds there are and how many ventilators and how many sick patients. And, you know, the other part of how we are recommending that these triage teams function is that they should be blinded to certain attributes of the patients, like their race and their social status and their gender and sexuality and all these other things that we think are irrelevant to how triage decisions should be made. So that instead of these triage teams actually seeing and evaluating each patient, they'll be given a very limited amount of information on only the key points that we think are ethically relevant in making allocation decisions. And they'll base the prioritization on only those factors in a blinded way.
Kiara, I know you've thought about med schools and training as well. And I guess one of my questions right now is what your biggest concern is in terms of trying to carry some of that training into an emergency situation around COVID-19.
Yeah, you know, I really applaud the work that medical schools and hospitals and residency programs are doing around implicit bias and making sure that healthcare providers, the doctors, the residents, the students are aware of this phenomenon called implicit bias. And are, you know, in medical schools, I've even gone so far as to administer the implicit association test to their students. And so this is a test that purports to reveal the extent of biases. And so the idea here is that if a person knows that they too possess an implicit biases, pro-white, anti-Black implicit biases, they'll be more cautious about acting on them when they go out and practice medicine. But as Doug said, you know, this is not, no one is accusing anyone of doing, of being biased intentionally, right? And so these are unconscious. People don't choose to turn them on and off. So we can have the best of intentions, but if you're in a time pressure situation, running out of ventilators, running out of beds, it's hard to say, well, I'm not going to act on my pro-white, anti-Black implicit bias today. I'm more curious as to why everyone has anti-Black, pro-white, implicit. And I say everyone because even people of color have pro-white, anti-Black, implicit biases. And the reality is that we've created a society in which we should expect people to have pro-white, anti-Black, implicit biases. We've created a society in which people of color are hyper-incarcerated, right? So we shouldn't be surprised if someone associates Blackness with criminality because we've created a criminal legal system that hyper-incarcerates people of color. We should not be surprised if we associate Blackness with poverty and indigency and laziness, right? And we shouldn't be surprised that we associate laziness with poverty, which is, you know, absolutely empirically inaccurate, but it's because people of color are disproportionately bear the burdens of poverty in this country. And so the solution to implicit bias is not attempting to cleanse physicians and clinicians of their implicit biases. The solution isn't to make them aware of their implicit biases and to say, you know, make sure you don't act on them today. But the solution is to create a world in which we don't have implicit biases in the first place. And so in order to create that world, we're going to have to do some, you know, mass reorganization. We're going to have to rethink how we distribute the benefits and burdens of capitalism. We're going to have to rethink how we address our social problems. We can't expect to have equality and equity in hospitals or in the, you know, in the healthcare provision space if we don't have equality and equity everywhere else.
Kiara Bridges is a professor at the UC Berkeley School of Law, and Douglas White is the vice chair and professor of critical care medicine at the University of Pittsburgh School of Medicine. And hey, you can listen to all of our coverage on COVID-19 by visiting thetakeaway.org/coronavirus.